I'm just asking for mercy, nothing else.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of It's Crime Time. I've been wanting to do episodes on the two cases that keep me up at night for a long time. Now, that's just kind of a figure of speech, but these cases are very old and many stories have been done on them before, but I would like to share them with you so you have an idea of what cases or what kind of cases have bothered me since hearing about them. I'm unsure why they bothered me so badly, but I think it has to do with the fact that they involve serious torture rather than the victims being killed suddenly. And the worst part of it is the torture of children at that. Now, not young children, but teenagers, but still pretty young compared to me. And of course, very undeserving of what they got. And the first case is the case of Sylvia Likens. And the second one I will do another episode on, but that is the case of Kelly Ann Bates. And in this episode, I'll be telling the story of Sylvia Likens. All right, everyone, it's crime time. Before I continue, I do want to place a disclaimer here that this episode has themes of torture, abuse, sexual abuse, every kind of abuse you could imagine. So I'm placing a warning here just in case, and you can feel free to click off at any time. As another side note before I continue, the audio featured in the beginning, that very small clip, is Gertrude Benachevsky speaking at her parole board hearing in 1985. Sylvia Marie Likens was born on January 3rd, 1949. She came from a large family that was poor and from southern Boone County, which is just northwest of Indianapolis in Indiana. Her father, Lester Likens, was born in Lebanon, Indiana, and had only an eighth grade education, and he worked many different jobs to try to make a living. He worked in various factories, he had a laundry route, and he unsuccessfully even owned a small restaurant at one point. He often then traveled with carnivals, selling food from his concession cart. Sylvia's mother, Betty, was born in Indianapolis on March 2nd, 1927. According to Jenny Likens, which is Sylvia's sister, Betty was a good mother to her children. But Lester and Betty had some marital problems that often led to them splitting up several times. Sylvia Likens was the middle child between two sets of fraternal twins, so that's kind of interesting. The first set of twins, Danny and Diana, were older than Sylvia, and then the second set of twins were younger than Sylvia, and the second set of twins were Jenny and Benny. On July 3rd, 1965, Lester Likens arrived home from work to an empty home. When he went looking for his children, he located Jenny and Sylvia at a location that has been listed as 3850 East New York Street. And this was the home of Gertrude Benachevsky and her children. Lester's wife had been in jail for shoplifting, and Lester decided he wanted to go back out and to work with the carnival again so he could make some money for the family because, you know, they had a large family. But since he'd be traveling, he needed someone to take care of his five children. So he made arrangements for the head of the household of the Benachevskys, which is Gertrude Benachevsky. He made arrangements under kind of a boarding agreement where he would pay Gertrude $20 a week, which in today's world or today's time, that would be about $150 a week. So that's a little excessive. Back then, that's rather excessive. Because they were very poor to begin with, and she would take care of them. So she would take care of Sylvia and Jenny for $20 a week. Lester, unfortunately, had not looked into the conditions of the Benachevsky home at this time. Otherwise, he most likely or most definitely would not have left his children there. Due to the home being so filthy, there was a lack of food and a lack of bedding for about 10 children. So, because Gertrude had a lot of children of her own and she was very, very poor as well. So of course she's going to agree to this because she wants the $20. Sylvia's brothers, Benny and Danny, were placed into the care of their grandparents or their grandmother. Sylvia's other sister, Diana, was 19 at the time. She was married and she was living on her own. And so this left Sylvia and Jenny to stay with Gertrude and her family. But Gertrude was just as poor as the Likens, like I had mentioned, and she had 7 of her own children to support. She made a little tiny bit of cash by ironing the neighbor's clothing, but as far as I know, that's it. So she didn't have like a full-time job. She had kids to take care of, and so she didn't have, you know, work that was consistent. Sylvia was considered to be a tough, confident girl, and she often went by the nickname Cookie. And she had a missing front tooth, so she kept her mouth closed when she smiled. She was said to be just very beautiful, you know, tough, confident, but she didn't like her smile. And then her sister Jenny was pretty much the opposite. She was shy, she was insecure, because she had this limp from having childhood polio. So she was rather reserved and shy. And Sylvia was, you know, I picture her being just that pretty bubbly girl that loved life, you know, even if she had to deal with, you know, the problems with her family being poor and everything of that nature, she was bubbly and loved life. So these girls went to live with Gertrude and her 7 children. And I'm going to list Gertrude's children so that when we talk about them later, you're going to know. Paula, 17. John Jr. was 12. Stephanie was 15. Marie, 11. Shirley, 10. James, 18. And Dennis, 18. 6 of these children had Gertrude's last name, Benachevsky, because it was the name of her ex-husband. But Dennis had the last name Wright due to him being Dennis Wright's child, who Gertrude claims was serving in the army in Germany. And John Benachevsky was apparently a police officer and was Gertrude's ex-husband. So from the beginning of all of this, when the children were boarded with Gertrude and the Benachevsky children, Gertrude's oldest daughter, Paula, was 17, and Sylvia did not seem to get along. And I have a theory for this, as do a lot of other people. But essentially, this is what began the events that occurred in this home between July 1965 and October 1965. Her and Paula not getting along. And I truly believe that Paula was very jealous of Sylvia because Sylvia was very beautiful, like I said, bubbly, and Paula wanted to be like her, and she couldn't, and she became jealous, and so did Gertrude. So they didn't get along, and the events that are about to be discussed are what transpired. So one day, Gertrude was expecting the money order from Sylvia and Jenny's parents, the $20, but it didn't arrive that very day when it was expected. So Gertrude took the girls upstairs, she slapped them, and said, quote, "Well, I took care of you 2 bitches for a week for nothing," end quote. The money order arrived the very next day. This was also a spark in what occurred in the home, as far as her not receiving her money orders on time or the Likens' parents struggling to pay on time. So this really, you know, agitated her, and she took it out on the girls. Which I don't understand, you know, if she's not getting the money anyway, supposedly, couldn't she just kick them out? I mean, honestly, living out on the street probably would have been a lot better than what they had went through in this home. But anyway, trust me, it's terrible. If you hadn't heard this story, Gertrude had been a very frail and underweight woman due to the family's financial situation and their lack of food. She did manage to enact corporal punishment on the girls with 2 tools or weapons, a leather belt her ex-husband left behind, and a fraternity-style paddle. And you can look up what that type of paddle looks like, but her ex-husband was a police officer and he left this leather belt behind, and that's what she used as punishment. When Gertrude was too weak from her asthma to enact the punishment, she left this duty to her eldest daughter, Paula, and then eventually to many others. Punishment began being handed to Sylvia and Jenny for various offenses that were relatively small, definitely nothing to get abused over, and it happened all the time. It was constant, and they got punished and abused for things they didn't even do. She just took it out on them all the time. One of the offenses was when they often exchanged soda bottles for change at the nearby grocery store, and I'm not sure exactly why she would have punished them, but I believe it was because the soda bottles were her family's, and they were drinking the soda that was provided to them by the Benachevskys, and they were taking the bottles and making change from them. And maybe, obviously, you know, they didn't share the change with Gertrude, and oh, they were her bottles of soda, so she was angry about it. I mean, that's what it seems like to me, on why you would punish somebody for doing that. Gertrude also often accused the girls of stealing, particularly Sylvia, so she would burn her fingers with matches. Jenny was expected to inflict punishment upon her sister, or she would be forced to take her place or get a worse punishment than Sylvia, so she was forced to do it as well. One time, Gertrude took Sylvia to this church function, and they went to these things probably because they had food there and the food was often free, and she forced Sylvia to eat free hot dogs until she was so sick that she vomited. And when she vomited, Gertrude made Sylvia eat her own vomit. So that's one of the most degrading things, you know, that you could do to somebody. It's disgusting. And I just think she enjoyed degrading and, you know, having other people around to watch it. She felt so good about herself. I think it just made her feel high and mighty to degrade a child. And that's disgusting. Children from around the neighborhood would also come to the Benachevsky home to take part in the torture and the punishment of Sylvia. So these neighbor kids are, you know, playing. They have nothing better to do, apparently, and they would come over and hang out with the Benachevsky kids. And they were horrendous. They were horrendous children. They were undisciplined. I'm not exactly sure where the hell their parents were when this was going on. It drives me insane to know that there was this many children that acted this way in this time period. So, but they were told by Gertrude that they could practice their judo or their karate moves on Sylvia, and they pretty much used Sylvia as their punching bag or their mannequin or their karate doll, whatever you want to call it. They beat her severely, and they kicked her up against the walls, and they were allowed. I mean, they thought it was fun, you know. You have her, at the time, guardian Gertrude, telling these children, hey, yeah, go ahead, beat her up, that's fine. And boom, they did it. So, disgusting. Once again, I'll probably say that 2 million times in this episode because, yeah. The worst part, I wouldn't say the worst part of it is, but these children just felt fine doing it. I mean, they felt fine doing it. They smoked cigarettes. They put their cigarettes out on her skin. They even cut Sylvia all the time. They just cut her skin. They would take salt and they would rub it into her open wounds, obviously to make her scream and make her in pain. And they enjoyed torturing her. They enjoyed watching it and enjoyed doing it to her. And this also helped Gertrude, because when Gertrude was weak and sick, she didn't have to do the punishment. The neighborhood boys would just do it. They would take care of it for her if her kids weren't doing it. One of the worst punishments handed to Sylvia, in my opinion, and also this is another warning, it involves sexual abuse, but this is probably, I think it's one of the worst, but there's, you know, there's a lot, was when Gertrude and her family and all the neighborhood kids would just gather in the living room like they were about to watch a movie and eat some popcorn. And they would have Sylvia stand in front of them all. She would undress, and she would be forced to insert empty Coca-Cola bottles into her vagina in front of the whole group of people. And they would sit and watch and laugh. Now, keep in mind, 100% true. Sylvia was a virgin. So, a virgin or not, a glass Coke bottle, that's terrible. But point is, she was a virgin. And they accused her of not being a virgin, and, you know, they had to sexually humiliate her all the time because they thought, you know, she was a little whore, prostitute, whatever they claimed she was. So this was a form of humiliation that Gertrude used, and she would give these sermons about the evils of sexual immorality. And Paula would stand there and stomp on Sylvia's vagina repeatedly while Gertrude's yelling at her about having sex, you know, before marriage, or being dirty and having sex. But Sylvia hadn't had sex. So, like, I don't understand where she got this from. She was obviously delusional. Maybe the neighborhood kids or maybe her daughter, Paula, said, hey, mom, you know, I heard Sylvia has a boyfriend and she's having sex, blah, blah, blah. And of course, she's going to believe her daughter. So, but I'm not sure where she got that information that Sylvia was sexually promiscuous. I have no idea. This is kind of wild to me because, disgustingly, Paula at the time was pregnant. And as far as I know, she was not married. So if she was, okay. But as far as I know, when she first got pregnant, she was not married. So her mom didn't abuse her for getting pregnant and having sex out of wedlock, but she abused and tortured a girl that was not her own for being a prostitute or a whore, and she wasn't. She was a virgin. And then Paula, obviously, who was pregnant, also accused Sylvia of being pregnant at the time. And she mutilated Sylvia's genitals for this. So Sylvia was obviously, like I said, indeed not pregnant. Sylvia then was also forced by 12-year-old John Jr. to lick the younger children's or the baby's soiled diapers clean. So that's pretty disgusting. And I'm not sure where the baby comes in. Obviously, I didn't find that mentioned. So apparently Gertrude had more children that we don't know about or that weren't listed that I could find the names of because they were, you know, very young. But and they obviously weren't involved in this. They were babies. But oftentimes when the beatings and humiliation would finish, Sylvia would be forced to take a scalding hot bath to, quote, cleanse her of her sins, end quote. She was severely burned and beaten when she would wet her mattress due to the abuse. And of course, you can look into this, but a lot of times children or people regress when they're abused. So especially children, obviously children learn how to use the bathroom properly, not wear a diaper anymore. But when they're abused, they regress. And her wetting the bed came from all of this abuse. So when she would wet the mattress, she would get severely in trouble and get even more abused. And Gertrude would recruit neighbor kids by saying that Sylvia had said bad things about them or bad things about their family, their parents, and these kids would get really fired up and mad. You know, they're believing the stuff that Gertrude's telling them. And then she even told her own daughter, Paula, that Sylvia called her a whore, which no proof that it ever happened. But, and why would she call her a whore to her, you know, like, why would you tell this girl that you don't like's mom, hey, your daughter's a whore, like, when you're already getting abused? Yeah, highly doubt it. I've read varying accounts about this next part, but I do know that they did see her, they did speak to her. But Diana, who is their sister that was out on her own at the time, met up with the girls, Jenny and Sylvia, and it said that they met up with Diana at a park in September. They told her about the abuse, they tried to tell her about everything, but she kind of believed that they were embellishing this, like, because it sounds so unreal. I mean, the things that were done to them, especially Sylvia, just sounded so unreal. Like, I think that's another reason this case bothers me so bad, because it's just so unspeakable. Like, you can't even imagine some of the things. So their sister kind of just thought, okay, you guys are being a little dramatic about it. And she kind of just ignored it. Then they met her a second time while with Gertrude's younger daughter, Marie, but they couldn't say anything. Sylvia and Jenny had then been given scalding hot baths after they ate sandwiches at this park. I guess they weren't supposed to eat. And Sylvia fainted from the heat of the scalding hot bath, and her head was slammed against the cast iron bathtub to wake her up repeatedly. And obviously that's not going to wake you up. That's going to knock you out. So these people are dumb. Sylvia and Jenny's sister, Diana, attempted to visit them at the Banachewski home eventually, like I said. But when she got there, she was refused at the door. So there was park visits. She didn't believe them. But then she kind of decided, you know, I want to check in on them for myself. But Gertrude wouldn't let her in. She said, if you don't leave, I'm going to call the police. So Diana hid in the bushes and waited until Jenny came out. She asked Jenny what was going on, and Jenny told her sister that she was not allowed to talk to her, and she ran away. I did find it in a source that Diana did sneak some food for Sylvia later. And Diana reported the abuse to a social worker, were called the school where the girls were going because Gertrude told her that she had kicked Sylvia out of the home for being a dirty prostitute. But when the social worker came to the home to check on Sylvia, Gertrude also told the social worker that Sylvia and Jenny had been kicked out of the home as well. So she told Sylvia and Jenny's sister Diana this, and then she told the social worker, well, they don't live here anymore. They were kicked out. And of course, the social worker concluded there was nothing wrong. We don't need to follow up anymore. And that was that. They never followed up anymore. Other neighbors were aware of this abuse and they were aware of the treatment of Sylvia, but they didn't report it. And some of them claim it was out of fear of their own lives. What bothers me the most is that these girls went to school. They went to normal school and no one reported it at school. And people in school saw the bruises and burns and beatings. How could you not? It was all over. She was covered. She was absolutely covered. So they claim they were afraid. But Gertrude, yeah, she looks, if you look her up, she looks like a bitch, but she doesn't look, you know, she's nothing to be afraid of. Like, yeah, she's going to kill her neighbors. Like, if you all band together, you know, band together and say, hey, we saw this girl, or we heard the abuse, because some people could say they could hear her screaming. The neighbors could hear her screaming and did nothing about it. You know, with that many people, what's this woman and a bunch of kids going to do? You know, like, I don't know, but different time period. Jenny was threatened, she was bullied, she was beaten also by the Benachevskis and the neighbors so that she wouldn't tell the authorities what was going on in the home. Eventually, Gertrude decided that Sylvia could no longer live upstairs with her children because she was disgusting, a prostitute, she was wetting herself. This is all things that Gertrude said. She wasn't fit to be around her children. So she threw her down the cellar stairs and she locked her in the cellar. And she was no longer allowed to leave the home either. So she couldn't leave at all, period. She was locked in a cellar. She was given crackers for her food and she was denied the right to use the restroom. She wasn't even allowed to go upstairs and use the restroom. So she had to defecate and urinate, obviously, in the cellar where she was living. Gertrude told her children and the neighbor children one day that Sylvia was a prostitute and she was proud of it, which obviously, once again, was not true because she was a virgin. She decided that she was going to etch these words into Sylvia's stomach with a hot needle and brand her with an S, which, if you look it up, resembled a 3 on her left breast on October 23rd. Richard Hobbs, a neighbor boy, helped to finish the etching on Sylvia's stomach. So her stomach said, I am a prostitute and proud of it. And then she had a S on her left breast, which resembled a 3. Neighborhood children would pay 5 cents just to view Sylvia's body and condition. So they would come over and Sylvia would be in the cellar laying, beaten, you know, hurting and being tortured, whatever. And these kids would pay 5 cents and go down and view her like some kind of circus attraction or it. I'm not sure. It's disgusting. I don't know what they got out of it, but I think honestly, they were just so shocked by the, you know, they paid to see it because they were just so shocked. I mean, it would be very shocking to see somebody in that condition, especially at the age of some of these young children. Sylvia told her sister Jenny just 3 days before she died, quote, I'm gonna die, I can tell, end quote. She died from a mix of internal bleeding, dehydration, starvation, and shock. And now to go back to this, her whole situation before she died, Gertrude noticed that Sylvia might be dying, so she planned to blindfold Sylvia and dump her body into the nearby woods with a note about how she was forced to give sexual favors to some of the boys, and when she refused, they beat her to this point. But Sylvia tried to escape when she heard that she was going to be taken to the woods and thrown. She ran out the front door after hearing Gertrude say this, and one of the neighbor boys stopped her, beating her again and throwing her back down into the basement. Sylvia was now fully incontinent, so she could not hold her urine. She was obviously urinating on herself uncontrollably, and she could not even speak correctly just due to the sheer amount of torture that she endured and just how much pain she was in and how much damage there was to her body. 12-year-old John Jr. attempted to clean Sylvia up by spraying her with the hose and laughing. And of course, hoses are freezing cold, so Sylvia tried to escape this time, and Gertrude caught her again at the bottom of the stairs and stomped on her head. So eventually on October 26th, 1965, the boy who had helped engrave her stomach, Richard Hobbs, was said to be the only one that showed any kind of feelings, any kind of, you know, sympathy, even though he did this to her as well. So I'm unsure why, but he gave her a warm bubble bath. He dressed her in clean clothes and he laid her on a mattress in a bedroom where she just never woke up. She passed away at the age of only 16. Before the police arrived at the home, Gertrude doused Sylvia's body in rubbing alcohol in an attempt to cover up any of the evidence, deflect blame. She thought that by dousing Sylvia's body in rubbing alcohol, it would clean her up a little bit, make her look more presentable. But obviously she had these wounds that you can't erase or delete a wound with rubbing alcohol. So I don't know what she thought about that, but she told police that Sylvia returned home that day in this bloody and dying condition. And she tried to nurse her back to health, but to no avail. And of course there was that note. So I guess Gertrude claimed that she came home that way. She was beaten when she was out and about and she tried to nurse her, but obviously it's clear that the wounds were not all fresh. But being this time period in the 1960s, I'm not exactly sure to what extent they could tell how old injuries were and everything. I'm not, you know, sure of that, but they definitely had their ways. They did conduct autopsies, obviously. So the police interviewed everyone in the home and even some of the neighbor kids. Paula told the police that Sylvia's death was meant to happen and then told Jenny that she was welcome to continue living in the Banachewski household if she liked. Yeah, that's crazy. Jenny was just 15 years old at this time when her sister died, but she was determined, very determined, to get these monsters that were her sister's killers arrested and tried and punished for her sister's death. She told police, quote, "You get me out of here and I'll tell you everything," end quote. Gertrude, Paula, Stephanie, Coy Hubbard, Richard Hobbs, and John Jr. were all arrested for Sylvia's murder after Jenny's statement was given to police officers. Five children from the neighborhood were also arrested for their involvement. When an autopsy was conducted on Sylvia, she had over 150 wounds, including the carving that was on her stomach. She had burns, muscle damage, nerve damage, a swollen vaginal cavity, fingernails that were broken backward, a hole almost completely to the bone on her right wrist, likely from a cigarette burn that, you know, a cigarette was just held on her wrist until it just burned a hole in her wrist. And this was almost to the bone. And she had almost entirely bitten through her lips when she died. They said that she bit her lips so hard, she practically separated them from her face. Her death was ruled as a homicide, with the cause being a subdural hematoma. A subdural hematoma is when a blood vessel in the space between the skull and the brain is damaged. This vessel causes blood to escape from it, leading to a blood clot formation that places pressure on the brain and damages it. Symptoms typically include an ongoing headache, confusion, drowsiness, nausea, vomiting, slurred speech, and changes in vision. This likely occurred when Gertrude stomped on Sylvia's head or when she had been thrown back down into the basement. But at this time, Sylvia was obviously feeling like she was dying. She knew. So she knew this was going to happen. And she was feeling very rough, and that's probably when she, you know, started knowing that she was for sure gonna die, is when this started happening. Sylvia was then buried in Oak Hill Cemetery in Lebanon, Indiana on October 29th, 1965. The trial was one of the most attended trials, and the testimony and indictments were shocking to everyone who had read the story. Gertrude and others had been punished and jailed for their crimes, but the Indiana Supreme Court reversed convictions in 1970 because the court refused motions for a change of venue and separate trials for those convicted. So they said they did not receive a fair trial because they needed to change the venue, because everyone in that town, you know, knew, everyone in that area knew these people and knew what they had done. A subsequent trial led to a guilty plea. Gertrude was released in 1972. She was tried for murder again, obviously, after this, and she was sentenced to life. But while in prison, Gertrude was given the name Dead Mother while spending 14 years in Indiana Women's Prison. So she got life in prison, but served 14 years. Despite angry protests collecting over 40,000 signatures to stop her from being paroled, she was paroled anyway in 1985. She changed her name to Nadine Van Fossen and died 5 years after in relative obscurity from lung cancer in 1990 in Iowa at the age of 61. Gertrude should have passed away in prison. She should have been tortured and beat in prison. I think very bad things about this woman. There's nothing good that she deserved ever. Now, I don't wish cancer upon anyone. That's one thing that, you know, I have a relatively dark sense of humor and I can handle a lot, but cancer is one thing that I do not make fun of. I don't wish it upon people, but her, you know, that's about the only torture she got that she deserved. She deserved far worse. Paula, her daughter, was also sentenced to life in prison in 1966 on May 25th, along with Gertrude. Paula was also retried, but instead of second-degree murder, she pled guilty to voluntary manslaughter. The daughter she gave birth to, because if you remember, she was pregnant when she was abusing Sylvia, in 1966 was put up for adoption. So she gave birth in 1966 after Sylvia had passed, and it was put up for adoption. She was released in 1972, despite numerous attempts to escape the prison. So Paula, being the terrible person that she is, tried to escape many times and still only did a little bit of time in jail. Well, prison. Paula later went on to have 2 children with her husband, and she changed her name to Paula Pace. And the worst part of it is she became a teacher's aide in Iowa, working with children. She shouldn't be anywhere near children, let alone out of prison. In 2012, she was finally fired from her job at the school after they found out her real identity. But I'm very shocked. Well, I guess I shouldn't say I'm shocked. You know, because no one noticed or reported Sylvia's injuries in school. So why did it take them so long to find out, you know, from however long in 1972 to 2012 that she was a child murderer? But she finally lost her job. Richard Hobbs, Coy Hubbard, and John Banachewski Jr. were given 2 to 21 years in prison at the Indiana Reformatory because of their ages. They were released eventually in 1968 after serving only 2 years of their sentences. John Banachewski Jr. became a lay minister in Texas and he counseled children of divorced parents. That's disgusting as well. I wonder why all of these people decided they wanted to work with children. Is it because they felt guilty and they thought that by helping children later in life, it would, you know, do away with or just erase what they had did to another child when they were younger? It doesn't erase it. But part of me feels, you know, they were children themselves. Gertrude had a huge influence. So Gertrude ultimately should have been, obviously, like I said, the one that died in prison. And I'm not saying these people don't deserve it. They definitely deserve more time. But Gertrude is the leading influence. Richard Hobbs died of cancer at the age of 21, 4 years after being released from the reformatory. And Coy Hubbard has had several other brushes with the law. Lester and Betty Likens eventually divorced. Betty remarried and she died in 1998 at the age of 71. This part kills me. Betty and Lester were obviously Sylvia's parents. And after Betty died, it was discovered that she had kept a suitcase filled with sympathy letters and pictures of Sylvia that she called her suitcase of sorrow. She's buried next to her husband, Wallace E. Grimes. So she's buried next to her husband that she married after Lester. But I can't imagine. I can't imagine, you know, being a mom and letting my child live with somebody who you think is going to take care of them. And this happens and you regret this for the rest of your life. So she wrote sympathy letters. And I guess to Sylvia and had pictures of Sylvia in there. And she just packed this all in a suitcase and kept it. 15-year-old Stephanie was never charged with the murder of Sylvia. She turned state's witness, and she actually ended up being released and moving to Florida. She changed her name to Stephanie Sarixthod and had several children of her own. Gertrude's other children were temporarily placed in foster care and then put into the custody of their father. Jenny Likens married and had two children of her own. She spent years on medication due to anxiety from watching her sister being tortured and murdered. Jenny says that she doesn't blame her parents for what happened during her childhood, and I can understand that, because her parents had no idea what horrors would befall their children, and they were just trying to make an income to raise them. Something I found interesting and hilarious, actually, like, go Jenny for this, is that when Gertrude died, Jenny cut out Gertrude's obituary and mailed it to her mom, Betty, with a note reading, "Some good news. Damn old Gertrude died. Ha ha ha. I'm happy about that." End quote. Jenny Likens Wade unfortunately died on June 23rd, 2004, at the young age of 54 of a heart attack. Some friends of hers say that she had this heart attack due to an unexpected knock on her door by a pizza delivery man who had the wrong address. So that just goes to show you how anxious of a person Jenny was due to what happened to her and her sister. Benny, Jenny's twin brother, who had been staying at his grandmother's at the time of the crime, is said to be... His story is said to be just as sad of a story. Or, you know, almost as sad. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia after his military service. He never got married, and his decomposed body was found on August 3rd, 1999. His body remained unclaimed and was cremated at the cost of the state. His ashes were buried in a grave in Oak Hill Cemetery near Sylvia's. Their father, Lester, had been trying to reach out to Benny when his letter was then returned, marked deceased. Lester wanted to reach out to try to help him, but of course Benny had been deceased and never received the letter. Sylvia's older brother Danny had been living on his own at the time of the crime and had been barely scraping by doing some odd jobs, much like his parents. He spent a lot of his time in pool halls and had a gambling problem, which was made a lot worse by his use of drugs and alcohol. He married a lady named Rosalie Weddle on March 21st, 1968, but they divorced and then she eventually remarried in 1981. After this, he was not heard of again until 2014, when he was 67 years old and detained on multiple counts and booked into Clark County, Nevada jail. I found an article that stated that the last update of him is that he was homeless and living near Las Vegas. He's refused all help from his remaining family. Diana had eventually stepped up for her sisters after the murder of Sylvia, supporting and caring for Jenny after the trial. She remarried and moved to California, where she cared for her father, Lester, in the last years of his life. Lester passed away in 2013. Diana has been said to be a wonderful mother and kind-hearted person, but is reluctant to talk about Jenny or Sylvia because it's too upsetting for her. She had been leading a quiet, normal life until one day she disappeared at 2 p.m. on Mother's Day in 2015. She was 67 years old at this time, and her name is Diana Likens Bedwell, and you can look her up and find the story. But her and her husband, Cecil Knutson, went missing after leaving Valley View Casino in Valley Center, California. They had spent their day playing nickel slots and were about to go to their son's house for a 4 p.m. dinner for Mother's Day, but they never arrived. A silver alert was issued, which is an APB for those 65 years old and older that are missing under suspicious circumstances. The couple's son, Robert Acosta, stated, "I don't know if they were abducted or just went down a nasty hill and we can't find them. I do know that my mom has to take frequent bathroom breaks, and so I worry about her with her jewelry on. All the things that are going through my mind, I don't know. I just need answers," end quote. He spent Mother's Day morning playing with his wife and child, and he was happily awaiting the arrival of his parents, who were usually always on time. Quote, "Everything was ready to rock and roll when 4:30 rolled around and they weren't there. I knew something was wrong," end quote. Air and ground searches were conducted, but turned up no sign of the couple or their vehicle. San Diego homicide detectives joined the investigation. The couple were last seen leaving the casino around 2 p.m. on May 10th of 2015, and financial records had made things look not so good for a safe return, as nothing had been spent by the couple since their disappearance. 2 weeks after disappearing, Diana and her husband Cecil were found on May 24th by a four-wheeling man in a remote and rocky area near Warner Springs along Route 79, 47 miles from the casino. Cecil Knutson, aged 79, was found deceased in a remote area of San Diego County. He had survived 1 week before having a heart attack and passing away. He was slumped over the running board of the front driver's door in the couple's Hyundai Sonata. Diana had been in critical condition and sitting in the passenger seat of the vehicle. Ciso had written a note and pinned it to a clipboard on May 17th, describing what happened after they left the casino in case their bodies were found. The couple had decided to take a route that they had never tried before, plotting the course on an atlas before taking this trip. Diana realized they were going the wrong way, and Ciso told her he knew where he was going. They came up on several impassable dirt roads, and when Ciso attempted to turn the vehicle around, he struck a rock and it became stuck. They survived on rainwater, an 8-pound bag of oranges, and a banana cream pie. Ciso had suffered diabetes and cataracts and was in remission for colon cancer. So his family members told the coroner that he had trouble getting around without his walker, but he was sharp as a tack. His cause of death is listed as an accident with contributing factors being cardiovascular disease, environmental exposure, hyperglycemia, and acute bronchopneumonia. Diana was released from the hospital and underwent rehab for her injuries. Diana stated in an interview when asked if there was anything that should be known about Sylvia and Jenny, and she stated, quote, "I will say one thing. They were both sweet, kind, loving, and trusting, and they were virgins. My sister Sylvia didn't even get to taste life. She was yanked up too early for any young lady. I just want everyone to know they were just sweet young ladies. It was a different era we lived in," end quote. This case has haunted me since I heard about it on two podcasts I previously listened to, as I stated in the beginning, and I feel I had to do my own, even if this happened so long ago. It hurts my soul to know what this family went through, and not only just with Sylvia, but with all the other members of the family. It seems as though one event in life can have dire consequences on the entirety of those involved. All right, everyone, that concludes this episode of It's Crime Time. If you enjoyed, please consider subscribing to me on Spotify and leaving a rating. Preferably Spotify, because this is the main platform I've been hosting on, but Apple Podcasts or whatever other platform you get your pods is great too. And thank you, and until next time.